I saw them eating, and I knew who they were. That's a Middle Eastern proverb that Jesus likely knew. Barbara Brown Taylor suggests that it doesn't make much sense in our own age of fast food and meals spent staring at our phones. But in Jesus' day, what you ate and with whom you ate it were critical matters. It was especially true among the Jews of the time, for whom eating together was literally a religious experience. To eat together was to celebrate their faith, which included very specific rules about what happened around the table. Cleanliness was paramount. Clean food, clean dishes, clean hands, clean hearts. A proper Jewish meal was a worship service in which believers honored God by sanctifying the most ordinary details of their lives. Jesus offended a lot of people with his table manners. He ignored the finger bowl by his plate. He ate whatever was put in front of him. He thought nothing of sitting down to eat with filthy people whose lives declared their contempt for their religion. People saw him eating and they knew who he was, someone who had lost all sense of what was right and who condoned sin by eating with sinners and who might as well have spit in the faces of the good people who raised him. Jesus tells the three parables of Luke 15, the lost sheep, the lost coin, which Hannah Faye just read a moment ago, and the story of the man with the two sons, in response to the religious leaders and teachers who were offended by his table manners. It's important to remember that context, because without it, the force of the parables is lost, and they become simply nice statements about God's persistent grace. Telling nice statements about the persistence of God's grace does not normally put one in mortal danger, but we should have no illusions here. Telling the three parables of Luke 15 put Jesus in grave danger. Now, lest we be too hard on Jesus' religious critics who spawned such danger, those to whom Jesus directed these parables, we should note that both sides in the conversation had substantive and compelling claims. We understand Jesus' point here, but the concerns of the Pharisees were rooted in warnings firmly fixed in that very first psalm about taking the path that sinners tread. In fact, they're the kinds of concerns we who are parents have often tried to pass on to our children. Choose your friends wisely, we say. Fred Craddock noted once that it was easy enough to sit at a distance and cheer on Jesus as he welcomed sinners and socialized with them. It's not nearly so easy to be his disciple in such a matter. The Pharisees were not alone in believing that the separation of good and bad people was a way of preserving a community's sense of righteousness and was essential for the moral instruction of the young. Jesus' failure to observe such distinctions seemed to some dangerous to the moral and religious fiber of the community and disturbingly radical. And it's still so regarded by some, even within the church. And yet this is what Jesus does. There's no escaping it, because each of these parables is a forceful revelation of the extravagance of God's concern for the lowdown, the lost, the outcast members of society. Taken together, these parables are a sustained testimony to God's passion and freedom in seeking people who appear to be insignificant and wayward, and to the unbridled joy of heaven over their restoration to the fold. A lost sheep, a lost coin, lost keys, lost wallet, lost cell phone. We all lose things. And normally, if we're able to find them again, we are grateful, we chastise ourselves a bit for our carelessness or our forgetfulness and try to figure out how not to lose them again. And we may even share the news with our family that we found what we were seeking. But these parables go a step further, and it seems odd the way they go. Mary Schurch says, rarely would we throw a party and invite the neighbors when we found something we'd lost. The shepherd and the homemaker, however, behave differently. With abandon, they gather their friends and neighbors and ask them to help celebrate the successful searches. The mood is extravagant and abundant and generous. The occasion is unambiguously designated as party time. What Jesus says here by such hyperbole is that the lostness of the human community is nothing less than a crisis, and its recovery is nothing less than a triumph. God's passion is bent toward the service of the lost. God's mercy is reckless and profligate. It is a passion for prodigals, and our visions of salvation are measly by comparison. We may not see the world the way Jesus does, but if we will but weigh his stories, we will begin to see that they really do contain some good news. They do, at least when we begin to grasp that we too are among the lost, sometimes more than we understand, often more than we're willing to admit. Sometimes we're lost of our own volition, hiding from the world for whatever reason. God still seeks us. Sometimes we're lost in grief and can find no solace. God still seeks us. When we're lost in self-righteousness and foolish pride, even then God seeks us. We get lost in myriad ways, and when we do, God always seeks us. We're sought by God. The only question is whether we'll let ourselves be found. Fred Craddock, that wonderful preacher, often told a story of how he and his friends would play hide and seek as children. The game was cheap, and they had a big backyard with a lot of good hiding places. You've played the game. Somebody is it, and whoever is it closes their eyes and counts to 100 and says, ready or not, here I come, and then goes looking for those who have hidden. Well, Fred said, when my brother was it, he cheated. He would start off well enough. He would close his eyes and he'd start counting 1, 2, 3, 4, 96, 97, 98, 99, 100. Ready or not, here I come. But Fred said, I didn't care, because I always had a great hiding place scouted out in advance. And I had one favorite hiding place in particular. I was small as a child, he said, and so I could squeeze into the space under our front steps. There were bushes that hid me from view. No one would ever think of looking back there. It was a great hiding place. My brother would come right by me, but he couldn't see me, Fred said. He'd go all over looking, and then he'd walk right back by, and I had to concentrate to keep from laughing out loud and giving myself away. I thought, he'll never find me here. He will never find me here. And then it hit me. He'll never find me here. And so after a while, Fred said, I would move the bushes a bit, and he'd come up and he'd see those bushes and he'd yell, I see you, I see you. And he'd run back to touch the base and he yelled, you're it, I found you. And I'd come out brushing myself off and say, darn it, you found me. Now, what did I want, Fred asked. To hide? Yes. Yes. What did I really want? The same thing as every person in this room today. Poets don't see a different world than the rest of us see. They see the same world differently. They describe things that many of us experience but either fail to notice or more feebly describe. Over time, I've been particularly moved by poets and writers who've described what it means to be lost, of the deep longing to be found. In 19th century England, as Francis Thompson was emerging from an opium addiction that had almost killed him, he wrote a poem, his one famous poem, in which he described God as the hound of heaven, pursuing him like a bloodhound might pursue a criminal. And so he ran as far as he could. I fled him down the nights and down the days. I fled him down the arches of the years. I fled him down the labyrinthine ways of my own mind, and in the midst of tears, I hid from him. More than 100 years later, Anne Lamott found herself in the midst of a similarly deep addiction. She too would experience the persistent seeking of God, but in her case, not as a bloodhound. For Lamott, who was scraping by on the shores of San Francisco Bay, it came in the form of a small imaginary cat. Everywhere I went, I had the feeling a little cat was following me, she said, wanting me to reach down and pick it up, wanting me to open the door and let it in. But I knew what would happen. You let a cat in one time, you give it a little milk, and then it stays forever. So I tried to keep one step ahead of it, slamming my houseboat door when I entered or left. The next Sunday, when I went to church, I was so hungover that I couldn't stand up for the songs. I stayed for the sermon, which I thought was just ridiculous, like someone trying to convince me of the existence of extraterrestrials. But the last hymn was so deep and so raw and so pure that I couldn't escape. It was as if the people were singing in between the notes, weeping and joyful at the same time, and I felt like their voices or something was rocking me in its bosom, holding me like a scared kid, and I opened up to that feeling and it washed over me. I began to cry and left before the benediction, and I raced home, and I felt that little cat running along at my heels, and I walked down the dock past dozens of potted flowers under a sky as blue as one of God's own dreams, and I opened the door to my houseboat, and I stood there for a minute, and then I hung my head and I said, I quit. I took a long, deep breath and said out loud, all right, you can come in. Behold, I stand at the door and knock, Jesus would say elsewhere. Behold, I stand at the door and knock. And he doesn't knock just once. He knocks again and again. Like a shepherd who won't rest until that one sheep is found. Like a woman possessed with finding a lost coin. Like a father who waits and waits and watches for a prodigal to return. Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If any hear my voice and open the door, I will come into them and will eat with them, and they will eat with me. It doesn't matter how you become lost. Jesus wants table fellowship with you. All one has to do is say, all right, you can come in. Doesn't matter if we're saints or sinners, whether we're clean or unclean, taxpayers or tax collectors, all we have to do is say, all right, you can come in. Of course, if we do let him in and sit at table with him and hear his voice, it might change everything. If we let him come to our table, there's no telling what might happen to our own table manners, because you know, Jesus seems always to be expanding the boundaries of and the borders of who's acceptable and who's worthy of a place at that table. If we let him in, eventually, we might just grasp what this seeker is asking of us. I've been thinking this morning that today is a wonderful day in the life of the church. You look around and you'll see more faces in the room than we saw all summer. Church school and confirmation are cranking up. The choir is full and stirring us with their music. We're so glad Michael Shaik and the choir are here. And Hannah Fay, and there's more good staff news to come soon. Stay tuned. If you stay for coffee hour, you may smile at the buzz today. In the days ahead, many of our programs will begin to take off. Our action teams and committees and boards are back from their summer break. The big yard sale is next week. It's a good day at Old First Church. But here's the trick, says Martha Stern. We are here doing church, and that's good. But we have followed Jesus in here, and we've invited him and gathered together so that this week and every week, we can then follow him back out of here. Because Jesus always seems to care inordinately about the ones who aren't here. Now, that interest may seem unreasonable to those of us who show up and who give our time and keep the church humming, but then again, it is the gospel. Jesus came to seek the lost, lost sheep, lost coins, lost brothers, lost prostitutes, lost loan sharks, lost politicians, all those forgotten about or dismissed because of their unworthiness are the very ones that Jesus has headed out to look for. And he looks back over his shoulder to see if we're following him.